Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. The topic for today is life in the military. UNCP is one of the top military-friendly universities in the U.S., as selected by U.S. News and World Reports, GI Jobs, and Military Advanced Education. We are proud to help military personnel and their dependents complete their higher education and fulfill their dreams. In this episode, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Jeff Frederick, is joined by four U.S. veterans: Weston Cook, retired history professor who served 22 years in the armed services; Mike Clausen, director of military outreach at UNCP who served 28 years in the U.S. Army; Jasmine Coleman, coordinator of military outreach; and Lewis Whitley, technology support technician in the Department of Math and Computer Science. Get ready for 30 Brave Minutes.
In the response to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, millions of Americans went down to the local recruitment or enlistment office and volunteered. 16 million served, representing between 9 and 10% of the population, and forming what has later been dubbed the, quote, greatest generation. Over a million were minorities. Over 300,000 were women. 73% of them spent time overseas, with the average overseas tour being about 16 months. Over a million American soldiers became casualties, and just under half of them did not survive the Second World War. Because the war was so global, and the stakes so high, and the enemies so sinister, and the support and response so strong, rank-and-file Americans understood more about military life in the 1940s and 50s than before or since. We knew someone who served, a father or a sister, a brother, son, daughter, cousin, uncle, or an aunt. We reveled in the surrender of the Germans and Japanese for the importance of the victory, but also because our loved ones would be coming home. And the occasional stories heard by those that did not serve from the men and women who did, whether they were told around kitchen tables, in barbershops, at Veterans of Foreign Wars or American Legion Lodge events, reinforced the basic notions of duty, honor, and courage. And polite folks learned soon enough not to ask about the stories that were only shared from one combat veteran to another. Those were sacred and only meant for those who had stood in the crucible. Life in the military has been a constant for a country founded on ideas of equality and democracy and protected by the citizen soldier who answered the call so many years ago at Lexington and Concord, and still today in Afghanistan, Iraq, and all over the globe. But today, instead of the 16 million plus who served in the Second World War, our muster rolls top out at around 1.4 million active duty, or less than a half a percent of the total population. All told, about 22 million living Americans wore the uniform, somewhere around 7% of our country. And of those, about a quarter never had to serve during a time of armed conflict. Breaking the 22 million number down further reveals that about 13% of American males have served, and about 1.5% of all current American females. There is an age dimension to understanding military life as well. If you're over the age of 50, 77% report having a direct family member who has served. But if you're an American between the ages of 30 and 49, only 57% have a family connection. Even further, those between the ages of 18 to 29, only a third have a family member who has served. As a result, our connection to understanding military life across rank-and-file Americans has receded. Going further, it seems clear that for those that serve, the notion of a military family or a legacy of a time or a career in the military as a family expectation remains fairly strong. In other words, military family connections are still passing down from one generation to the next. Yet in the same vein, families without a military connection are becoming more likely not to have a young family member enlist in the all-volunteer military. To summarize, Americans, nearly two decades into the 21st century, are less likely to serve themselves or have an immediate family member who is serving or who has served. And this presents any number of problems. Voters will elect politicians who make decisions about using the military, and those voters have little or no working knowledge about life in the military. a society which has promised to honor and provide for veterans through educational and health benefits, seemingly has little understanding of the demands of military service or the needs of those who are no longer on active duty. This is problematic. How do we take care of the very women and men who protect our freedom if we know so little about what they endure on our behalf? For 99 years, we've celebrated Veterans Day, first in commemoration of Armistice Day, which ended World War I, then after 1954 in recognition of the value our military men and women bring to our nation. Separate from Memorial Day, which honored those who gave the last full measure of devotion, Veterans Day calls attention to all who have served. So even as we celebrate just a couple of weeks ago, too many Americans no longer understand much at all about what life in the armed forces is about. Our topic for today, life in the military. I welcome and thank each of our panelists for their service, Weston Cook, Mike Clausen, Jasmine Coleman, and Lewis Whitley. Let's start at the very beginning. Tell us about your decision to join the service. Why did you join up, and what branch did you choose?
My decision to join the military was almost a foregone conclusion. I knew that someone in my family would serve because we came from a tradition of service. I just didn't know it would be me. And what kind of helped me make that decision, especially since I went to a peacetime army, was the college benefits. I actually decided to join the Army because I grew up in an Army town right next to Fort Bragg, so everyone had a general knowledge of what Army service was. My father had served in the Army. My grandfather had served in the Army. I even had a grandfather who served in the Navy. So, again, that history of military service was there.
It was one of the family businesses.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And so I decided to join the Army, and I was able to go to college and do a bunch of other great things as a result.
What about the rest of y'all?
Well, I wish I could say that I had some patriotic, virtuous thoughts, and I was joining for that reason. So it wasn't so much about why I joined, but why I stayed, because after I got in and served, I felt more patriotic, and I ended up staying 28 years. But I found in most of my experiences that most people at the age of joining the military, 18, 19, or 20, are joining for, one, they've just broken up with a girlfriend, number two, it's very cool, or number three, they are patriotic. And again, I joined because of the cool factor. You know, I wanted to go fly helicopters, and that's what I got to go do. But after I got into the service and started serving, it was more about staying for the right reasons, not so much it was a cool thing to do to join up. But
it was cool, though.
It was. So I obviously must have enjoyed it. I stayed there long enough.
Absolutely.
So. My reason is almost the same as Jasmine's. When I was getting out of high school, I tried to go to school, didn't have any money to go to school, so military was in pretty much the main option at that point. And since my dad, he was actually a retired Army, so I kind of went along the same way. I went towards the Army route and was able to go in. And this was in 2006, so we were still at wartime, but it wasn't blooming. So the kind of the patriotic push was a little down at that point. But usually once I got into basic training and started getting through all that stuff, that's where you start seeing more people start building the more patriotic background. Most people tend to go in for school or getting their citizenship, because I remember a few people doing that too. But after kind of going through the basic training, the AIT, and at least a year or two in, they start becoming more proud of what they're doing. There's a more sense of duty behind their position and their struggle.
I grew up in a town, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which was sort of accidentally military. We had a small Army base. We had a large Pease Air Force base, was the air representative. And, of course, the Portsmouth Navy Shipyard. My father, my grandfather before him, and quite a long ways back, were basically old salts. They were in the Navy for a varying period of time. My father had served for 26 years, fought in World War II and fought in Korea. But I also was raised with a certain amount of diversity. My mother was a Quaker and a quiet pacifist, as were her people. So we grew up, I grew up surrounded by this. And then when I went to the University of New Hampshire in 1964, I'm the gray hair of the bunch. it was essentially put to us that unless there was a compelling reason, you would serve in ROTC. Well, you know, that was sort of, I was now beyond the age of 16 where I had to brush my teeth. There were new chores I had to do, like joining ROTC. And I found I sort of, in a bizarre way, enjoyed it. So from there, I eventually, after going to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in 1971, came on active duty. And like Michael, I served for 22 years, having resolved when I first got in that, well, I'll try the skates, and then when the ice melts, I'll go do something else. But every time I got ready to do something else, they came along and said, we know you want to quit, but how about a couple more years? I discovered I liked soldiers. I liked working in Washington. I liked working in foreign countries. I liked having this feeling that I was doing something good.
It's great stuff. Well, let's start at the very beginning. Okay, you've signed your papers. You've come in. What's next is boot camp. Talk a little bit about that. What should we know about it? What did you gain from that experience? Bring us inside the drill sergeant mentality for just a minute.
From the beginning, my first experience, before I even shipped out, I was told I would go to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, because it was close to where I was, and the actual advanced training I needed to do following on was at Fort Jackson. So I went to Raleigh, to the MEP station, the recruiting station. I did my final oath of enlistment, and I was prepared to get on a bus to go to Fort Jackson. And at that point in time, they called out names as to who was going on a bus and who was going on a plane. And they called my name to get on a plane and go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. So I immediately took the little bit of time I had left to call home. And I called my dad and said, hey, change of plans. They're telling me I'm going somewhere else. And he says, oh, well, you're in the Army now. So I think that was a good beginning, because I learned from the onset that I did serve at the needs of the Army, and where they wanted me to go is where I would go. And so that helped me throughout my initial training to know that anything could happen. So just be prepared to adjust and adapt and drive on, which is something that was reiterated throughout our training. For me, I was 18 at the time, so these are really my young adult formative years. That's what that time frame was, and I think that military service and learning that nothing was going to necessarily go as planned, but you had to adjust and still accomplish the overall mission, it helped to form me now to where I can deal with changes and react to things in a short amount of time and still come up with a satisfactory resolution. So even though there was some moments, I kind of felt like basic training was almost out of body. I even told my drill sergeant towards the end, they actually relax a little more and they'll talk to you when they know you've met all your requirements. And they said that you never really, nothing ever seemed to faze you. And I said, well, you know, in the Army I went into, they couldn't hit me and my mom could. So and they paid me and fed me. And so that was pretty cool. You could get money and they yelled, but they didn't hit you. So it was okay.
How about the rest of y'all?
Mine's kind of pretty close to the same. When I went to MAPS and everything, I actually went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, back when it was all male. I think now it's co-ed now. But one of the things that I kind of learned there was weather changed a lot often. So you'd be training in the snow in the morning and then that afternoon it'd be about 90 degrees. Mm. So they had you start your training without any cold weather gear, knowing it's going to be a heat casualty in the afternoon. And one of the things that I always kind of made sure that they made sure that drill instructors was to make sure you get everything done whenever you need to. And one example of that is even through the stress through it all, like I actually ended up breaking my foot at basic training, but I was still making sure I got through all the rug marches and got the runs done just so that I'd make sure I can get out of basic training as fast as possible, because nobody wanted to stay there more than they had to.
I had to smile at the out-of-body experience, because that was sort of the experience I had at basic training. But I started off very well in a very unusual way. I decided I would be the grand mediocrity. I'd be the quiet guy with the glasses. Except that about 3 days in, one of the sergeants comes and says, there's a cottonmouth moccasin over there. and I want you to take care of him. Well, this was Fort Benning, Georgia, so it was not surprising. And I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do. Me and this other guy go over there, and I look at him and said, Georgie, I spent 4 years as a nature counselor. That's a common water snake. Sarge don't know that. We do. So we brought that snake to old Sarge, who went screaming yellow bonkers, and from then on, we were heroes. Nobody seemed to want to contradict us about what kind of that snake was. By the way, we did snake let the snake go, for all of those of you who are nature lovers. But it really was Alice in Wonderland. You were getting up at all strange hours of the morning. You would put your boots on, and then you'd realize they were the boots of the guy in the bed next to you. And any day, you'd do five different things that involved discomfort, sharp objects, loud noises, and people who were told really did like you, but they sure acted like they didn't. And it was, I think, the thing I really got out of it more than anything else is, if number one, if you pay attention, you'll be okay. Number two, if you didn't pay attention, maybe there's somebody who can help you. And he knows or she knows they're going to need your help sometime. And we can all get through it together. It's like the first sergeant said, good training. Somebody lose something, learn something, nobody dies. Mm.
Yeah, my experiences were pretty much the same. I ended up where Jasmine wanted to go. I started off at basic training at Fort Jackson. I got there. And I was a little different because I was an OCS commissioned officer. So I'd been through college. I showed up to basic training, and they went, wow, and their Army's infinite wisdom, I was a PFC, a private first class, as opposed to privates. So I was instantly in charge of a 60-man platoon, of which I knew no more than any of them. And it was a matter of learning prioritization and staying awake during the day, and you'd be just fine. But my reward for getting out of basic training was going to officer candidate school, which is really a step different in basic training for officers. And as much as I despise basic training, boy, that was a picnic compared to officer candidate school, as I learned. But it truly is, both basic training and officer candidate school, a mammoth physical training exercise, and how much grief they can give you and how you're going to stand up to that. And if you can endure, you're okay. And what it does teach you is teamwork, which Weston talked about, which is probably the most important thing to learn in the military. It's all about teamwork and getting a mission completed, and just having your buddies back. So in the end, when looking back, it was all worth it, and I can kind of grin at it. At the time, I was going, what have I done to my life? But it worked out.
We'll return to our panel in just a moment. UNC Pembroke and the College of Arts and Sciences are changing lives through education. To learn more about our 16 departments, college highlights, and news, as well as to find past episodes of 30 Brave Minutes and our digital journal Bravery, explore our website. You can also support our academic programs by clicking on the donate button. Additional news and events may be found by following us on Facebook at UNCP College of Arts and Sciences. Remember, wherever you hope to go, whatever you plan to do, you can get there from here.
How much input did you have in selecting your area of expertise or specialization, what you would do within the service, and how much did they sort of shape what you could and could not do?
I picked my MOS. I picked it based on the fact that I came into the Army knowing I planned to get out. I knew I wasn't planning to retire. I knew I went specifically for the college benefits and to be able to access a VA home loan. I was looking at my life after the Army when I started out. So my recruiter wanted me to go to language school and be a linguist because of my testing. My scores were high. And he said, oh, you can go to Monterey and it'll be great and you'll be out there. And you just have to enlist for 6 years because you're actually going to be in training for 2 years. And I said, that's not going to work for me. I got something to do. So what's the shortest school you got? And the administrative professional, the personnel administrative center clerk, a PAC clerk. So at that time, it was a 71 Lima. You went to school for right at a month for your AIT after basic. And I said, that's good. I already know how to type, and hopefully I can get a desk because I plan to put a picture of my mom on it. And that was my 18-year-old wisdom, that it's not going to take too long. I already have the basic skills, and just get me out of there fast enough. And it actually worked out to my advantage, because after basic training and the initial getting acclimated to, you know, military custom and courtesies and that lifestyle, the advanced training was easy because they wanted to know if you could type and do memorandums. And I'd already taken computer applications and other courses in high school. So I actually got a little bit of a reprieve and could focus more on making sure I just met the physical requirements and kept up with my training that way. So I was glad that I was able to pick what I wanted, and it worked out for me in the end.
My recruiter actually didn't have any input on my MOS. Initially, I was actually going to do 68 Whiskey, which at the time was combat medic. And on the way up to MEPS, I was kind of thinking about it, and I decided to just change it, because when I looked at an MOS, I wanted something that either I could do in the military for long term or come out of the military and do in the civilian world. And so I changed it from combat medic, which as you can only be like an EMT here, to 15 Quebec, which was an air traffic controller. And then the experience for that training there was, after I went from SEAL, I'd go straight to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and then I pretty much spent almost, I think, another 5 or 6 months in that training alone, which as was initial CTO, then you go into the tower, you learn the radar, then you learn all the equipment training. And the interesting thing is you come out of that with a CTO, you can control in almost any tower, and as well as you're getting about a year plus of education as an air traffic controller to learn that on the civilian side within less than 4 months. Doing it with the Army.
Do you think you liked being in air traffic control more than you would have being a combat medic?
Yeah, there's a little bit more problem solving. It's a lot more stress as an air traffic controller, but there was more possibility of kind of going to an area, building something up, being able to take it down and go instead of being a combat medic. You're just always going with different units, not knowing what to expect. At least as a controller, you know your area. You've kind of gotten mapped out. You know what your runways are going to be, whether you have to build it or not, or what kind of landing you have. So it's a lot more prepared. So it's a little less of a what-if game as an air traffic controller compared to a combat medic.
When I was in ROTC, they gave us our junior year a piece of paper in which we were required to pick three branches, and the top one had to be combat. So with very little thought, because I didn't know how to think about it, I put at the top infantry. Second, I put quartermaster. And third, I put military intelligence with equally less thought. When I went on active duty in 1972, it was back to Fort Benning, Georgia, and I was pretty sure I was going to Vietnam. And then one day the colonel comes in and says, all you folks who have got orders to Vietnam, you're not. And so a few weeks later, I found they sort of needed quartermasters. I was changed to quartermasters. I spent a few months with a quartermaster at Fort Benning who took me aside one rainy afternoon and said, Weston, you're good at a lot of things, but you're, as a quartermaster, I'm afraid either you're going to get your boss relieved or you're going to get relieved. Let's talk about that military intelligence thing. I've got some friends in personnel. And so the quartermaster link disappeared. The military intelligence infantry stayed. And that set my pattern for a career. So it was a mix of both the institutional way of doing things and, you know, like the song says, you got to have friends.
Yeah, I think the services like to give everyone what they perceive as a choice because it makes them feel good. But in the end, the services are going to assign you to the needs of their
choice in quotation
marks. Correct. Because I, too, got three choices as an officer. But I got the choices, but it wasn't exactly the path I thought I was going to take to get there. Again, I went through basic training, then officer candidate school at Fort Benning as an infantry officer. And I was, at that point, believing I was on my happy way to flight school. Well, I got to flight school, but it was about 18 months later because I had to serve as an infantry officer first. So I did have control, I guess, or at least choices of where I wanted to end up. And I did end up getting my first choice. It just wasn't the direct path that I thought. So, again, the services, all the services will do that. They'll do it for the needs of the service. But they do try to put – they try to give you somewhat of a choice, and because that impacts not only you but your family if you're married and have kids and that sort of thing. So truly your family is serving with you too. So having a choice helps, especially if you serve more than one tour, because as you move on in your career, you know, you're never in a job, especially as an officer, more than 2-3 years at a time. In fact, here at UNCP is the longest I've ever had a job. You know, it always changed every couple of years. So they do have to make consideration of what you want, but they also put the needs of the service first, which should be what it's all about, because it's about something bigger than you anyway.
Talk a little bit about your time overseas. Where are some of the places that you've gone, and what was the reaction of local folk in other countries to understanding that you were an American serviceman or woman, and how did they relate to you?
I can address that a little bit. I spent some time in Europe, Germany and Spain. I spent time. I had two tours in Afghanistan, two to Iraq, and so it really depended upon where you were. For example, when I was traveling around Europe while I was stationed in Germany, I'd go to France. We'd visit France. If you were to visit in the if you were around the Parisians, they certainly appreciated what you had done in the past or what the American military had done in the past. But, you know, it was so-so. You were treated like any other tourist. But if you went to the Normandy region, you were treated like you just, were the king. Mm. And in places like the Middle East, Iraq and Afghanistan, most of the population was very, very friendly to you. But you didn't know whether they were going to come up and put your arm around you or want to do something far worse. So you just had to be careful. What I did enjoy traveling around the world more than anything is meeting children, because they were fascinated with the military, the American military soldier. I mean, here you're walking around with high-tech night vision goggles, weapons, you're driving and flying machines that they can't even imagine, and they're just in stricken poverty. Mm. And a piece of candy would brighten their day and have a friend forever. So for the most part, American soldiers were treated well, but, for obvious reasons in other places, they were trying to kill you. So that's the way it is.
Others of you who were overseas?
I had assignments where I was stationed overseas. I actually was able to take my family to Korea and to Morocco. And in those countries, because we knew some of the language, we were able to get along very well with most of the people. And even in those times when we weren't, we had some pretty fascinating discussions. I mean, just as Michael said, people are extremely interested in you. You might very well be the first American they've ever met. Mm-hmm. And they hear a lot about Americans because, as an Egyptian told me, you people are inescapable. Nobody can get away from Americans, even if you're not here. I had some tours in and out of Africa, Germany, Lebanon. Lebanon things got hairy for occasions. I remember even in times of argument that people always were interested in what Americans liked, what they did, what they thought. I remember a guy from Tunisia who was very angry about something we did with the Palestinians, but he ended by saying, "But I like American music." And I always remember him when I remember that the Arab Spring, with the fall of the Tunisian dictatorship, rocked to the beat of American rap. Nobody gets away from us.
And it's interesting you say that, because even today in Iraq and Afghanistan, if you'll see a lot, the old boom boxes that mm-hmm. we used to have in the 70s and 80s, well, that's still pretty popular in a lot of those remote villages. And all you hear is American music booming across those things mm-hmm. constantly. It is pretty funny. They love the American culture. They know what they've seen on TV and the movies if they've had a chance to see something like that. And sometimes the press perpetuates things that just flat aren't true. Mm-hmm. And then when they meet you, they see the difference and they're confounded by something like that.
Obviously, the military has prepared you all very well for the rest of your life, because you've all been extraordinarily successful in the different things that you've done since leaving the service. Talk for a minute about the best memories. When you think back about your time, what makes you feel so happy to have served?
My best memories are always associated with the people that I served with, I'm still friends with, people that have that shared experience and the bond, the lifelong bonds that you form just based off whether it's someone from basic training, whether it's someone you went on a deployment with, whether it's someone you knew from being assigned somewhere stateside, and maybe that was a family that hosted you when you were by yourself at Christmas. They invited you over. Those experiences with individual people and the care and compassion that was shown to me during, especially during the time that I started out with my enlistment. I was 18 years old. This was my first time away from home. And actually, it's funny, I was in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. That was my first duty station. So it's you go from, you know, North Carolina where there's green trees and terrain that varies to really where it is flat and open. And I could always sang the from the musical Oklahoma. I was like, oh, the wind really does roll down the plain, and it pushes you over. And sometimes it smells like skunks, but that's okay. But I really met some of the best people just being in the military and going to places that I wouldn't have otherwise been. I mean, even my husband, I met him through being in the military. He's from Raleigh. I'm from the Fayetteville area, and we met in Oklahoma. So it's always funny that we're both from North Carolina, but
we'll tell the Oklahoma Tourism Board that part, not the skunk part.
Exactly. But it is those shared experiences with your battle buddies and with the people with whom you serve. That's the best takeaway for me from my time in the military.
I kind of go along on the top of the people, but also the stuff that you kind of learn and the stuff that you'll experience, most people tend not to experience. Like being able to ride in a helicopter, not too many people say they've done that. Well, I can say I got paid for it in doing that. And not only that, but you kind of learn of ways to kind of get stuff done. Even if it's kind of a bad task, you know to get it finished. And it kind of actually makes you look better when you start working for others who tend not to be around that all the time. That if there's a bad task and you're willing to volunteer for it, at least makes you look a lot better. Mm-hmm. So at least the biggest thing that I've always kind of enjoyed was being able to take the worst situation and try to entertain yourself with it more than anything else, honestly.
I guess I'm going to sort of put the two perspectives we've just heard together. I met so many men and women who made it possible for me to do things I never imagined I could do. Two examples. I got to teach at West Point. I remember as a kid, 1950s, gray television show, watching a show called West Point. And all of a sudden, here I am. I'm there. We had an episode in 1980 where there was a terrible earthquake in Algiers. The Algerian high command sends an officer to our attaché and says, we don't like you and you don't like us, but we need help. What can you do for us? And we helped to get all kinds of supplies over there to the people. And it was an incredible sense of energization to work with a lot of folks. Third, my first sergeant was an incredible man. At Fort Carson, he taught me how to be a company commander. I commanded two companies, and this guy was airborne ranger, and he memorized huge portions of the Bible, Alice in Wonderland, and a number of other books. And he always had a quote. But I will never forget one time, in a moment of despair, I said, Top, I don't know how to do this. And he just smiled and said, sir, the correct statement, if I may, is, you don't know how to do it yet.
Yet.
And I owe that to the Army.
So true. My memories are no different. It is about people. And I think related to what Lewis was talking about, you know, there's a saying, especially in the Army, embrace the suck. So when things get bad, you're all in it together. And when it's over, it's not a bad memory. And you realize you can do almost anything, no matter how miserable it gets. In the service, you know, what they say, it's always mission first, but it's people always. And so it would be hard-pressed to serve and not have the best memories of people. The other thing I'd like to mention is it's not my fondest memory, but it's strong memories in the fact that those that you have lost, that you were close to in combat or however, Because what it does, when you do think about it, is make you really appreciate what the service does and what it's really about. Mm-hmm. And so I try not to take things that I used to take for granted.
Yeah.
And I think I'm a lot better at that, but it's still difficult. Because we are, you know, here in America, we live so much better than anyone else. But there are people that have to pay the price for that.
The things we complain about and the problems we have, people would all over the world would gladly exchange with us.
That's so true. You can ask Jasmine. She's in the office. I find myself whining and complaining about something, and then I'll just go, you know what? There's no one dying, and there's nothing on fire. This is just fine. There is nothing here that I have
to
worry about.
It's just Monday here.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. So,
well, final question. With such a huge number of people who don't have a direct relative in the military or have not served themselves, what's the one thing you'd like them to know about what actually goes on in military life?
I think the overall thing I would want people to know as far as military life is you oftentimes hear people just offering blanket statements about you being a hero. And I would say that the military just provides ordinary people with extraordinary opportunities, and they place you in extraordinary circumstances at times. But you're still a regular person. It's not you. It's just by the nature of what you do for a living. I think maybe some of the recruiting commercials are a little more effective than we would think, because people assume everyone does these high-speed tactical operations every day in the military. And some of us have regular jobs. You have people that are cooks. You have people that are admin. You have more support MOSs than you actually do have as far as combat personnel. But in gaining just a basic understanding, just know that we're regular people. We want to be treated with respect and courtesy, and we'll extend the same kindness to you.
The big thing I've got to say, I'm not so sure if this is for all Army, at least, but I know for sure for aviation, is that it's a lot smaller than you ever expected.
Hmm.
I remember my NCOIC for the unit I was part of, his best friend was my old drill sergeant, and we actually ended up training with him afterwards at in Simmons Army Airfield. So I saw him a few times. And another example is my father-in-law that he was a private with went to OCS, got his flight. He actually ended up becoming my commander.
Wow.
AIT.
What a small world.
It surprised me of how much I ran into people of, oh, I know that guy. It's like, yeah, that was my boss for a while. It happened all too often.
I'd like to strike very quickly something that you said at the beginning, Dean Frederick. You know, there's a lot of talk in our politics today about the 1%, about this class of people who seem to own anything, everything. But there's a 1% too, a less than 1%, and that's the number of American men and women who have served their country in the military over the last 20 years. That is only talked about very often in these kind of cliches. Now, we're not ninjas. We're not Kshatriya warriors. We are not this aloof breed of high-tech mercenary special category of combat people. But what we do ask, and we ask of every American, have your leaders and you yourselves think about what you're doing before you send your sons and daughters to war. That probably is the most important thing you can do, because when you thank us for your service, for our service, make sure that our service was meaningful when you decide about the lives and the families of the men and women you will send into combat.
I would just add, just to play a little bit off of that, based on what everybody else has said without repeating, I would just maybe like to remind folks that haven't served in the military, you know, there are so many stereotypes out there. We don't drive, you know, four penny nails with a sledgehammer. We think about what we're doing. We really do. It's not just about combat. In fact, you know, less than 10% of the military even serves in combat. It's not about shooting and killing, and it's about keeping the peace and doing the right things, nation building, winning hearts and minds. And just as an example, today, if you were to look at the services, if you look at some of the services' strategic missions, they're being charged with global warming, that becoming a threat to the world. You know, how does that affect what, you know, our security for this nation, or obesity, believe it or not, because less than 25% of America's youth can even qualify to get into the services today because they're either overweight, which is the worst, the biggest problem, but they either have a felony record or some behavior problem. But obesity is the biggest problem. And the United States Army, for one of the services, is charged with figuring out what to do to fix that because they can't get, you know, soldiers in shape enough to help defend the country if need be. So my point just being is, hey, it's more than just a big hammer out there. There's some of the smartest people I ever met outside of maybe this university were in the Army. I mean, they had PhDs from Princeton and everywhere else. And there are people leading this country trying to do the right thing.
What a fascinating time. Thank you for your stories and your reflections. Thank you, of course, for your service and for all you've done for our country. But mostly, thank you as well for letting those of us who have not served be able to see a little bit inside what your life in the service was like. We thank you. We thank those of you who are listening, and we hope you'll tune in next time for more 30 Brave Minutes.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or Indian industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!